All right, coming up, we're going to talk a little bit of Minnesota Timberwolves, and then we're going to go back in the huddle with a little bit of an NFL preview talk with Nate Tice from Yahoo Sports. That's coming up right now. All right, now joining me from not the Atlanta Hawks anymore, not Warriors Media anymore. It's from NBA on NBC, Grant Liffman. How you doing, man?
Hey, man. It's been a long time. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing great. But welcome back to NBA Media, man. You're joining NBC Sports with their NBA on NBC crew. Wow. What a crew, man. Putting it together. I like the players NBC Sports has assembled. I like the media members they've assembled. You come out of nowhere after 3 years of the Atlanta Hawks working in their front office. You're back.
I'm back.
NBA League Insider. Awesome, man.
Do you know how many texts I got from media? People would be like, welcome back to the dark side, man. And I'm like, man, I don't know if media is the dark side, but I'm super excited. Yeah. How about that group that they put together with NBC? It's like, I'm in awe. I feel very fortunate and lucky to be with the group. And I'm back with the Peacock, man. That's where I got my start. It was the regional sports network, NBC Sports Bay Area. Shout out. It's very exciting. Yeah. How about those names? Carmelo, you know, I'm excited to see him do his thing. You know, I'm here. Mm-hmm. You know, the guy has a wealth of knowledge. You know, you got Grant Hill, Jamal Crawford, Trace McGrady, like Reggie Miller.
Michael Jordan.
I was trying to bury the lead a little bit here. I've just been going crazy because for some reason, every time they do the PR releases and everything, my name somehow always is next to Michael Jordan. And my friends think it's the funniest thing in the world because like I have absolutely no business being near his name. But oh, man, I'm taking screenshots. I'm taking this and that. No, Michael Jordan. Yeah, he's part of it.
I mean, it's pretty cool. I look forward to seeing like T-Mac and Vince Carter as well. Like there's just a lot of interesting additions. I feel like it's going to be able to tap into the nostalgic aspect of what some of these names from the late 90s, early 2000s, but also just a lot of people who are great in NBA media today. So I'm very excited about Jamal Crawford as well. I don't know if you mentioned him, but like he's super talented. I love what he did when he was at TNT. So I'm excited about the NBA on NBC Sports team. Excited that you're there as well. So let's talk some NBA here, man, because we got some news this week. De'Aaron Fox signed a four-year, $222.4 million extension with the San Antonio Spurs after they got him for fairly cheap via trade earlier this year, but he does get the full max contract. What do you think about the way the Spurs are building this out around Victor Wembanyama, Grant, with drafting Dylan Harper, adding De'Aaron Fox, already got Stephon Castle there, last year's lottery pick? What's your assessment of the way they're building this roster out around Wemby?
You know, it's funny because they obviously didn't know they were going to have a chance at Dylan Harper, right, in the offseason. So they added another guard, and people were like, why are they going guard heavy? It's that they took the best player available, and that's what they did. And what do? You get as many good guards as possible. Look how the NBA is built now, right? You have the lead guard. That's who the guy you're talking about. I mean, it's kind of always been that in some shape or form. But I feel like back in the day, the wing position was the premier position that you'd be building your team around. But when you have a freak or an alien like Wembanyama, you know, the guard position means a lot. And he covers up a lot of the issues you may have defensively, et cetera. And you get to kind of pick your poison when it comes to the player you want leading your team. And obviously the Spurs thought De'Aaron was the guy, and that's why they traded for him. I know there was some speculation like, oh, are they going to pivot now that they have Dylan Harper and Steph Castle? And no, they know he's their guy. He's a guy that they feel like can get a bucket whenever they need it. He's a guy that can lead their team, a guy who wanted to be in San Antonio. And, you know, back in the day, San Antonio was a destination because it was a powerhouse for so long. But, you know, San Antonio is one of the, you know, a smaller market team. So when players really want to go to San Antonio, it means something. And it was really cool that De'Aaron wanted to be there. And I think he's going to be a perfect fit just in terms of running the team. I think, you know, with Steph Castle and Dylan Harper, you get a really chance to build up of strong backcourt that you have multiple layers, multiple rotations, different styles. I'm a huge fan of Castle. When I was with the Hawks, we were very high on him, and he ended up being just an absolute stud. And Dylan Harper has a chance to be a stud as well. So the pivot points are great. I love the way they're building it. They're I'll give them credit. They are not rushing the process. They are taking their time and building something special. You can't rush something when you want to make it great and if you want to have longevity. And that's what they're trying to do is get it right.
It doesn't feel like they're skipping steps. No. That's for sure. Because there could have been opportunities if they wanted to make trades. But they ended up passing on a lot of those opportunities. Like if they wanted to have the best offer for Kevin Durant, they could have had the best offer. But they decided not to have the best offer. They're deciding to play it a little slower. With that said, though, you know, Dillon Harper, extremely talented. De'Aaron Fox, obviously a very talented point guard. Stephon Castle wins Rookie of the Year. He's more of kind of a Swiss Army knife type of point guard, but still very talented guard. My concern pre-draft was always with Harper, is there going to be enough shooting for this team when you're building it around Victor Wembanyama? And Spurs fans, you know, very mixed. A lot of Spurs fans tend to, you know, agree with me. More Spurs fans tend to think like you're crazy, like you're underselling what these guys can become with development over the course of time. Where are you at when it comes to that simple aspect about the amount of shooting that they have around Victor right now?
Shooting matters. Everything you're saying is very true. In today's NBA, if you look at the teams that are successful, shooting and shooting at a high clip and actually shooting a lot of threes too, but just at a high percentage matters. And when you want to give Victor some spacing, that does matter. And if you want to give De'Aaron Fox some spacing, he also needs some shooting as well. So,
and Harper.
Yeah, no, Harper as well. And Castle, let's be honest. So the point is that everything you're saying it is right. You know, they have Vassell, they have Champagne, they have other guys that can shoot, obviously. Harrison Barnes, good from the corners. But I think at the end of the day, shooting truly, truly, truly does matter in the NBA. And if it didn't, obviously, it's like the point of the game is put the ball in the basket. But spacing is just everything in today's league. So I do think they're going to have to add more shooting. I don't think there's a rush. I think you were right. They have the opportunity to get guys. They're kind of taking their time. They're feeling it all out. Maybe they end up using one of their guys as a trade piece in the future. But in the time being, I think they're going to feel it out to see what they can do and see what they have with the spacing currently set.
Now, with Fox, I tweeted out how saying, like, I don't love it for the Spurs and getting the full max. I mean, Fox, I think, is a very good point guard. I don't think he's like a truly great point guard. And year by year, he's going to be making $49 million, $53 million, $57 million, and then $61 million in the final year of his four-year extension. And Spurs fans are saying, well, you know, if Harper becomes a star, we could trade Fox. But I think in the NBA nowadays, there's so many teams that have good lead ball handlers that, you know, Fox at that point in his early 30s, making $60 million a year, actually that salary might not be that tradable at that point. What do you think about the salary they gave him? Are you surprised at all that they gave him the full max? Because I get it, but also I'm not totally certain that it's not going to end up being some, you know, anchor when they try to build this out 3-4 years from now.
Well, that's the thing is that back in the day, it would have been such an obvious, yeah, you give them the max. That's what you do. The new CBA has changed things. It really, you can't have money just bloated on your books because then you're dealing with the aprons and you only have so many slots and the max contracts are getting very expensive, right?
It's crazy.
But having said that, the Spurs did acquire him thinking he's a max guy. Right. And so I'm not surprised they gave him the max just because that's what he was going to get when they acquired him. That was going to be, you know, they're not acquiring him thinking they're going to get him for less. Will it end up being a good contract, bad contract? I guess we'll see. Right. And that's where the Spurs are banking on him being one of those leaders. Like, so they're hoping off the court and on the court, he brings something for them. But in terms of the idea that you can just trade a guy, it doesn't work like that anymore. It really doesn't. It's hard to trade guys in the NBA, especially with big contracts, especially as getting older, because teams, especially as you said, the lead guard position, if a team's going for it, quote unquote, they usually have a lead guard. That's usually part of it already. If you're bringing in a lead guard, you're revamping the whole system. Everything is going through that person, right? And so if you're already in that place, you're matured enough that you're like, this is our final piece, you're kind of changing the whole system again when you bring in a point guard. So that's what the Spurs did early, right? You bring in your lead guy, you change your system, whatever. So just trading for a big contract later on, it's not as easy anymore. Maybe you can do one for one where you bring in another veteran guard and you just kind of change out contracts. But to your point, it's not as simple as it used to be. Do I think it's a good or bad contract? Again, we'll see. They acquired him knowing he's a max guy, and they weren't going to get him for less. So the one thing I'll push back on is the idea that you just trade him. It's all good. It doesn't work like that anymore.
For sure. And ultimately, if Harper becomes a star, that's a good problem to have, right? I mean, it becomes a good problem. If Harper in year three is a first-time All-Star and Fox at that point is then in the second year of his contract, then it's like, oh, geez, there's a lot of money. It's a good problem if you're thinking about trading De'Aaron Fox because Harper is already that good, right? So I think that's a good sign there. And with Harper, we'll see. I mean, obviously, I think pretty close to consensus second best prospect on a lot of people's rankings. I still have concerns about the jumper. We'll see how that develops over the course of the year and the years to come. I'm not going to overreact there. But with the Spurs, I get it. I get what they did trading for Fox. I get what they did giving it. It's just that there is an element of risk here. Whereas with, you know, the Spurs, I think they'd love to be, you know, that rival against the Thunder, you know, competing for championships. You know, Chet versus Wemby, you already get that. I'm sure the NBA would love that as well. They're not close right now. And I'm not quite as high on what the Spurs have as a young team as I was with the Thunder, you know, 2, 3, 4 years ago with what they were building out around SGA. And I think they have a lot of work to do, a lot of young guys that need to get better over time. And, you know, you mentioned, Grant, like trading point guards. The first big move that the Hawks made when you were hired to the team was trading for DeJounte Murray from the San Antonio Spurs. And one of the other big moves the front office made was trading DeJounte Murray away from the Hawks to the Pelicans. So you've seen kind of the challenges in building a system around an incoming all-star caliber guard. And you guys already had Trae Young, you know, doing that. So you have like firsthand experience seeing that.
Yeah. No, the week I arrived in Atlanta was DeJounte Murray. The trade went through, and I was like, I think it was like my second day. I was like, whoa, we did what? And I like walk in and I'm like shaking hands with DeJounte. I'm like, oh, hey, man, like, welcome to the Hawks. I'm new here too. You know, it's obviously a different situation because Trey is so ball dominant, right? It's more of an old school style way of playing where the point guard really leads the team. The ball's in his hands every possession, right? He leads the league with time with the ball and usage, etc. So like when he has the ball in his hands, the other guard is playing off of him, right? So it ended up being a little tough because both of them are so ball dominant that it was like your turn, my turn a little bit more than I think originally wanted. And that's kind of what happens, as you were saying, with just acquiring a guard. And so when we traded DeJounte, who's a great player, and he was great for like when Trey was out, DeJounte did his thing. It's just when the mix sometimes was not clicking the right way. But when we traded DeJounte, we got a guy that wasn't a guy who needed the ball in his hands all the time, right? And then you put that next to Trey. So as you're saying, like with Dylan, with De'Aaron, with whomever, you know, you have that, you'll build it out the way you want. Steph Castle can play off De'Aaron Fox, but Dylan Harper's a ball in the hand guy, right? So you'll just have to build it out in a way that it works for the time being. But at some point, a decision will probably have to be made. You're not going to be able to go like the Indiana Pacers love the fact that they have Halliburton, Nembhard, McConnell, right? And that was a great combo between them. But all of them played their role specifically to what they needed. Can the Spurs build that? Yes. But we're talking about three lead guards in the Spurs eventually. The hope is three lead guards. McConnell's not necessarily that guy that's running a team. Nembhard, maybe could be, but like right now,
maybe.
But Halliburton is the guy.
For sure. I mean, with the Pacers, it's going to be interesting because Carlisle said this week on Caitlin Cooper's podcast how he expects Mathurin to be the starting two. So you're going to have Nembhard and Mathurin with a lot of opportunities without Halliburton all of next season. And so with Indiana, like what you're speaking to, the way there's a hierarchy with some of these teams, with the Pacers, with the Thunder as well, behind SGA. They have a lot of guys who can handle the ball, but Cason Wallace is happy being a 3-and-D guy. You know, Jalen Williams can be the second guy, and sometimes he can be the lead guy. Jalen Williams is kind of positionless, but you get what I'm saying there. They have a bunch of guys. Caruso, who comes into the NBA as a guard, but he's you know, switchable defender type of guy. Castle might have to be that in a lot of situations for the Spurs. And I think, you know, when teams are building out their roster, you mentioned the DeJounte Murray trade last year, you get Dyson Daniels back. The fit made sense next to Trae Young. And he has this unbelievable season. He really explodes last year, best year of his career with Atlanta. Did you guys perceive Dyson Daniels as a guy to make that leap, or did he exceed expectations beyond what you anticipated?
We thought he had a chance to be a really, really good player. And we just thought it would take more time, right? Because you bring in somebody who just didn't get a lot of action the first two seasons. You don't know what to expect. But when we started watching him, you know, we had been scouting him for a long time, and we loved Dyson, and we really targeted him when the time came. And when we looked at him, we brought him in thinking maybe he'll come off the bench at first, maybe he'll do this. And then we start seeing him at the Olympics, and you see this bravado start to come out on him a little bit. He had this different way about him, and you could see this confidence growing. And then he comes in and we see him in our building, and we're like, man, I don't think you can take this guy off the court. And you're just like, but you hold your breath because you're like, listen, your training camp is only so much. You don't really know. Olympic stage is different. And then he just kept on going and going and going. We're like, man, we just cannot. This guy needs to start. This guy needs to play minutes. This guy needs to do all these things. And he definitely exceeded expectations of how quickly it happened. What happened, though, is something that we were hopeful for. And I think that the number one thing that needs to be said about him is the work ethic and the person he is. We were very confident the best of who he was, his talents, was going to come forward because he is just an A-plus person. And that's one thing that we tried in the Hawks. When we drafted Zachary Risacher, when we brought in anybody onto the team, that person had to be the work ethic had to be really great. The person had to be great. And so, like, just Dyson was one of those guys that we brought in. And it was funny because we traded him in the deal. We also got Larry Nance, who we really wanted as well. He's a special player.
Love Nance.
Great, great locker room group. Like, just an ape.
He's got everything except durability.
That's poor it. Guy.
He's got everything
poor
else.
Guy. Just he plays so hard and then just gets these freak injuries. But this dude works his butt off. He is just an awesome dude. And I remember asking Larry early on, and we're in training camp, and Dyson's doing his thing. He's shooting the three ball. He's just locking people up, doing all this stuff, bringing, you know, chest pumping a little bit. And I'm like, Larry, was this always Dyson behind the scenes? And then, like, maybe the bright lights hit. And he's like, no, man, I'm telling you, ever since that change of scenery, he is just a different dude. Huh. And he came in the building, and even in training camp, like, he just felt like, hey, I can just kind of throw away who I was before, who was a little timid sometimes, maybe a little, you know, trying to be too unselfish. And he took this new persona in Atlanta, not as a person. He stayed the same person, but he kind of came out of his shell basketball wise. The game slowed down, and Larry confirmed that. We were like, okay. So what we're seeing is real right now. And he's like, oh yeah, absolutely. And then it just kind of blossomed, and we were excited.
I'm very excited to see Dyson Daniels' brother, Dash Daniels, who's going to be a potential lottery pick in the 2026 NBA draft. 6'6", another, you know, really good guard defensively. Like, it's going to be cool. We get two Daniels in the NBA who can be these ferocious defenders.
First of all, they're like little mini clones of each other. And also just that family, A-plus family, like more Daniels. Like, mm-hmm. They should, as many Daniels as he comes, keep throwing Daniels into the league. Yeah.
Grant, what was your most unexpected lesson working in an NBA front office?
Ooh, that's a good one. I think the most interesting lesson I learned was every transaction that happens in the NBA, and from an outside perspective, and especially on the media side as well. On the media side, you know things, you hear things, but you never get to say it out loud a lot of times because it's not confirmed. But people just kind of around the NBA kind of whisper things. You kind of just kind of accept it. You know. But what I learned the most was when a trade happens or a transaction happens or a signing happens, I would say 90% of the time, the public will never fully know why something happened. What was the actual reason? It could be standard, just like, you know, that 10% of the time where it's just like, hey, talent for talent. We just want to upgrade here. This team wants to upgrade here. The money works. Let's make it happen. But there's always some factors of, you know, like the personal relationships or this or that. And there's so many different politics at play. And there's so many different like things that sometimes you look at a trade and go, why did they do that? And you may never know because that team just is going to hold, and a good team doesn't leak out reasons, right? If a person, if a player is unhappy, if a team is unhappy, if a coach is unhappy, you know, all these things. And so, you know, a good team doesn't just rag on a player if they leave and you go, oh, the reason we got rid of him is because of, you know, or if a player wants to leave, they try not to be like, well, this team is bad because of blah, 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 blah. So there's a lot of things that just get held internally, and the public will have their opinions about it, as they should. This is the part of the game. It's exciting. And you can break down trades, but every now and then you got to remember that if something just seems a little off, there might be something you just won't know.
Is there an example you can give of that?
I knew that was going this way. I think at the end of the day, there's no specific example I'm going to give, but dynamics and how people like...
Well, one that I've heard, to tell me okay. am I right or wrong here? I heard last year, Quentin Grimes didn't want to be in Dallas after Max Christie got there, and that there was kind of a mini trade request. And that's one of the reasons why he ended up getting sent to the 76ers.
Right. So I can't confirm or deny because I wasn't there for that one. But what I can say is situations like that, and I'm not going to say him particularly, what ends up happening is people that are coming up on free agency, especially younger players, a lot of times if they're not getting the role that they expected, or their agents, a lot of times, by the way, agents push for certain things. Players don't, you know, yes. keep put their hands up.
And exactly. Block agents. It's not like Grimes is asking for it. It's the agents trying to steer.
And again, I'm not necessarily saying Grimes. I'm using this example here.
Exactly.
Is that it's never a mean-spirited or nefarious thing that's happening. It's more like, hey, this is my career opportunity happening here. And it's not that a guy's not a team player or this and that. This is literally their livelihoods, right? And if someone's not getting opportunity with free agency coming up, they go like, hey, I want to go to a place where I get to actually show my skills so I can sign that contract and then kind of go back into the role of like, I'll do whatever is necessary type thing. I know that a lot of times players get a bad rap, or people think that's they're not a winner. They don't care if they're like trying to get theirs. I mean, at the end of the day, like, these are jobs and people are trying to make as much money as they possibly can. And that should be, you know, some of the part of the factors into any decision. And for a lot of young players, again, it's much harder to say, to sacrifice and say, don't worry about it, I don't need mine, when I haven't signed all that money. If you already have $100 million, sure, maybe it's a little easier to say, you know what, I'll take a step back and do a little less so someone else can do more that makes the team better. So I can't confirm or deny anything about Grimes. I wasn't there, but I think a lot of people a lot of times take a situation like that and say, oh, this guy's not a winner, this guy's not that. Like, at the end of the day, like, if a guy's about to hit free agency, he probably wants a hole.
What's it like being on your side when you get media idiots like me criticizing your team and saying things?
No, you know what's funny is that, like, you do learn is not you, but there's a lot of voices out there. There's a lot of voices out there. And the main guys, you and a lot of the national people and a lot of the great beat writers of the teams. Like, there's so many great beat writers. And I wish people read a lot more of the beat because they're there every day, right? And they're grinding and stuff. But there's a lot of like aggregation and like rumors and created rumors and those things. And a lot of those are just false. They really are. They're like, we would get some rumors sent to us and people would be like a player would reach out and be like, what's this? And I'd be like, literally, that was made out of nowhere. I have absolutely no idea where that.
Sentinel. You got Sentinel.
Yeah, exactly. It really felt like that. It felt like someone was kidding. They're like, this guy hates this person and has requested a trade. And the guy's like the happiest person on the planet. He's like, wait, what? So like, it's more of that type of stuff that's more, but like, no, like the people like you, KOC, it is an honor working with people like you. And it is just, I'm one of you. I am that. So I hope people say the same about me now.
I'm asking past Grant, that guy, yeah. Hawks Grant.
No, it's more just the fake rumors that come out that were just like, cause then a lot of times you actually have to deal with them. And that's the thing. That's the number one thing also that I learned is how plugged in players, ownership, leadership is about Twitter and rumors and stuff, because they have to be a lot of times, because agents are getting this and that and being like, yo, why am I seeing that this is being out there? And then we're like, A, I have no idea where that came from. B, it's completely false. And C, now we probably actually have to call that person or a PR team has to call that writer and be like, yo, where are you getting this from? Because now our player is upset because you just created a false rumor about him. And so it does actually hit within like the organization, right? And so that is one thing I learned, is that just how impactful social media is and just all media is.
It's funny because I remember years ago when the Celtics traded for Isaiah Thomas, I wrote an article for Celtics blog at the time saying the Celtics should trade for Isaiah Thomas. Here's why. Years after that, somebody from the Celtics front office said to me, like, did you have a source when you wrote that? I was like, no, I was just putting pieces together. I know Ainge had interest the summer prior. And I felt like it was a need that made sense. And I posted it probably a week before the deal happened. And I was like, no, I had no source. Like, they're like, we thought we had a leak. Like, I was like, no, I didn't know anybody at the time when I wrote that. But that was one of the first times, you know, I really got an example of, okay, yeah, they're really monitoring this stuff because they need to for people management. So to your point, it's about people management.
It is. And that's probably at least half the job is people management. And that's the number one thing about all of this, is that creating a culture is just such a buzzword nowadays. It's just like, oh, we need a good culture. But like, this is a people management world. And much less than the past, probably. You probably could have gone away with a lot more in the past.
For sure.
So,
one of the people management things that comes to mind, just everything you're talking about there, right there, Grant. The Warriors with Kuminga a couple of years ago, you know, the public statements about his role in Kerr, and then he has a great run, but then he's out of the rotation. And now we're in a situation where he's stuck in restricted free agency limbo. The last time you were in media, the Warriors were just coming off a title in 2022. And everything that's transpired since then, they haven't made it out of the second round. They have Jimmy Butler now. And now Kuminga is in this situation during an offseason in which the Warriors haven't made a move yet. They're just waiting. Are they one of the teams waiting for Giannis, as Shams kind of alluded to over at ESPN? What's the deal with Golden State right now, Grant?
Well, first of all, it is funny because my last season with the Warriors and covering the Warriors was the championship. And I remember we're on the court in Boston and Bob Myers comes out with Jonathan Kuminga, who was a rookie at that time. And they're laughing and they're on our show. And Bob says, like, if it was up to Jonathan, he would have been starting this whole series. You know, somebody tell this guy. And it just showed, again, Kuminga laughed it off. They laughed, right? But like, it just shows his confidence. He has this, like, I want to be out there. I want to be playing. And he's a skilled young kid. He's confident. He's smart. But like, factoring just fit, it's hard sometimes. And sometimes it's just a skilled player doesn't necessarily always have to fit with another skilled player. There's different stylistic plays and everything. As you're saying, the Warriors will always be big fish hunting. As long as they have Steph Curry, they're going to big fish hunt. When Steph Curry's gone, they're going to big fish hunt because they need to replace Steph Curry, which is impossible because Steph Curry is a unicorn. But like, the point is that if Giannis, sure, they're probably, it would be crazy if they weren't trying for him, right? Can you imagine putting Giannis with Steph? They're trying to keep Steph Curry's window open, right? That's always the talk. Two timelines, window, championship window. Can you get it? Steph Curry is going to make you a championship contender no matter what, right? And so going for big fish, 100%. You don't have as much time to just get a bunch of young guys and develop them to 3 years from now, be like, all right, now let's go for it. And that's why they're going for Giannis, right? Or supposedly. So I would just say that, like, for them with the Kuminga situation and everything, while Steph Curry is, just an absolute legend, one of the greatest players of all time, blah, blah, blah. I can go on forever about him. And A-plus human, like, he's just great. Simultaneously, it is difficult to play with him sometimes. Not because he's difficult, but his movement is so unique out there. And understanding what to do with him is so unique. In a Steve Kerr system, which is very free-flowing and movement and passing and ball movement, this and that, it's different than you've played your entire life and you get to that court, right? Because you were the guy and you probably got fed the ball in the post and you did this and you're working on your Kobe Bryant moves and you're working on your Kevin Durant moves, who's just also elite and pretty quick tangent. It's pretty incredible that Kevin Durant with the Warriors worked so well because like he adapted so well to the way the Warriors played, which is very hard for a guy who had played a certain way his whole life. And I don't think Kevin Durant gets enough credit for that as well, because everyone hears the end of the how it all ended and blah, 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 blah. Kevin Durant adapted as much as he could and was pretty amazing that he could do that despite how he played his entire life where he was a Hall of Famer. Anyway, going back. So with Jonathan Kuminga in these situations, it can be difficult to adapt to a Steph Curry. If you don't adapt on the fly, and for these young players, that's why you see so many maybe not necessarily work out with the Warriors sometimes, and they have to go for veterans because they understand the game has already slowed down. They have understand that movement a little bit more. But again, playing with Steph Curry is such a unique experience for these players. You need the right fits for that.
It's clear to me that if the Warriors do indeed keep Jonathan Kuminga, they want to be able to trade Jonathan Kuminga. Like, that's clearly what I'm thinking is the approach here, because with the nature of the potential contract he could sign, he would automatically get a no trade clause, which would mean, oh, suddenly he can't be dealt as a salary and deal A, B, or C sometime down the line, and it'll come next February or whatever. The Warriors, if they keep Kuminga, though, and if he does have that no trade, or whether he becomes a guy for the next year, two, three years in the roster, like, you're talking about how the Warriors want to maximize their title window. They try to do that by going to get Jimmy Butler, who helped, of course. They were much better after getting him. Draymond Green and Steph both, you know, flipped the switch and turned it on second half of the year last year. But to me, keeping Kuminga is contradictory to that, because he doesn't mesh within this system, because it doesn't work very well next to Draymond and Jimmy Butler in the front court. I've got a hard time completely understanding what they're doing here, other than that they're just trying to salvage what has been a botched developmental plan over the last 3-4 years with Kuminga.
It is a situation where it's really weird. That's it's one of those random situations where leverage is left all sides. Like, I've never fully seen it. It's difficult. It's really
That's
hard
true.
Because in one world, you'd assume a Jonathan Kuminga a couple years ago would have gotten a huge contract this year from a team, but no team has cap space. Only one team had cap space enough to give him the money he wanted, right? So now you're talking sign and trades. Well, guess what?
And the Nets said no. Right. The Nets were
exactly.
like, no.
So they're doing something else. So now you're talking about sign and trades. And sign and trades are not the same anymore, because now most teams are limited in what you can do with a sign and trade in opportunities because of the new CBA. So all these factors are playing in. And meanwhile, the Warriors are like, even if we wanted to trade you, there's just not the same market as there was before to do so. So all the leverage is kind of lost for every side, right? Kuminga could try to delay a year and get the qualifying offer because there's going to be much more cap space the following year. But I'm sure in his mind, it's like, well, what if I don't play well or don't mesh well again or something happens? And so in the Warriors, meantime, are trying to win. And they're like, hey, if you are all in, we can try to win with you for now, but we do recognize that this is not the imperfect fit. And then it's like, it's just like a whole, it's an interesting situation where just no one has leverage.
I wish at the end of the day, Kuminga would embrace the role Kerr envisions for him. And that's being like a new age Sean Marion. Sean Marion was a great effing player, dude. He was a great player on winning teams. Like, to me, like, if you're Sean Marion of this team, you still got a long career ahead of you if you want to someday be that star. But, like, to be that star, maybe you have to be the Sean Marion first. And, you know, I don't think there's any reason to believe that he will embrace that role or want to take on that role. But more than anything else, I just wish Kuminga would make that choice to be that guy, because he has the tools to be that guy. He just doesn't have the mindset to be it, which speaks to your earlier point, Grant. Drafting guys who are, you know, A-plus character guys, not that Kuminga isn't, no, just like, I'm not saying that about him as a person, but A-plus character guys in terms of embracing a role on a team as well as part of that equation. And Kuminga, it just, it's been a total mismatch with, you know, that choice years ago, taking him over Franz Wagner, which was a mistake by Bob Myers.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's Franz, to a lot of people, he was a confounding prospect. They didn't really understand what he was going to do. JK, he's so talented. And I know you weren't saying this, but he actually is a great dude. You weren't saying that. You were talking about accepting
everything I hear.
Yeah, he's a really cool guy, smart dude, funny. But like, at the end of the day, you're right. It's just, fit matters, right? Role matters. What a person wants matters. the biggest thing for Kuminga is like, and this is going to go back to a point you made earlier, like if he could shoot consistently from the outside, this fit actually works a lot better than you think it does. Like it actually can work. But the problem is when you have him out there with Draymond, and maybe not Loon's not there anymore, but like other guys, it's just the shooting is so, it's just not enough spacing. The not enough space for Steph, movement, everything. People can crowd the paint. And so if Kuminga's shot was a little better, there's a moment in his second year, you're like, oh, is this starting to come along? But it kind of regressed a little bit that, unfortunately, like that is a part that just makes it hard. It makes it hard. It's a hard fit. And I feel for the Warriors. I feel for Jonathan Kuminga. Again, all the leverage has kind of just been lost. And I want all sides to succeed because they're just all great people. It's a very smart team. All these different things. Steph Curry window. Draymond Green, Jimmy Butler, JK getting his money. I want all those things to happen. It's just really a tough situation right now.
Well, I look forward to seeing them actually make a move this offseason with whatever they do, whether it's bringing back Kuminga, signing Horford, or who knows. We'll see what they do. Grant, thanks for joining me, man, and big, big, big congratulations again, man. It's awesome.
Thank you, dude. I'm so excited. NBC is gonna be awesome. It's funny, like you and I, like we grew up watching NBA on NBC. That was it. It was like premier games and just having the music back and like just they're going to bring some elements of Sunday Night Football, which is like the greatest.
Let's
like
go.
It's just going to be awesome. And I'm glad I'm part of it. I'm going to be doing just kind of talking with NBA like you're doing right now of just explaining trades, analyzing why it happened, talking about those type of things. I'm gonna leave the news breaking and stuff to the much more talented people than me. It's just gonna be me just, analyzing basketball and talking basketball. And that's what NBC is trying to do. Let's get back to talking basketball, enjoying basketball. We're gonna try to highlight players, talk about them, just bring the love of the game back. And that's let's talk some hoops. That's what we're trying to do. Let's talk some hoops, man. KOC.
Yeah, let's do it, Grant. We did it today. This is fun. Thank you for joining me today, Grant. Have a great day, man.
Thanks, man. I really appreciate it.
All right, coming up, we're going to talk a little bit of Minnesota Timberwolves, and then we're going to go back in the huddle with a little bit of an NFL preview talk with Nate Tice from Yahoo Sports. That's coming up right now. All right, joining me now from Yahoo Sports NFL, co-host of the Football 301 podcast, it's Nate Tice. Nate, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. It's great to meet you, basically, essentially. I mean, I think it's only been written word I've interacted with you so far. No, it's great to meet you, KOC. I keep saying KOC, but I'm talking about the Vikings head coach lately. So I have to shift my brain a little bit to Yahoo's KOC. No, but it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Stolen nickname for Kevin O'Connell. Stolen nickname.
I had to clarify that on the show because I said KOC. And I was like, Yahoo's KOC because you posted a video on something. And that was
so good. Former Patriots backup. I never could have imagined he'd be a great NFL head coach backup for Tom Brady. And one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you on today, Nate, is because I'm trying to get back into the NFL after some years away. After Tom Brady left the Patriots, my dad passed away that year. We used to watch every game together. So it's like the Patriots faded away. Wasn't watching games every Sunday. Tom Brady leaves, goes and wins the Super Bowl with the Bucks. But I haven't really watched the NFL as closely the last 4-5 years. But this year, I'm rejoining my friends, high school friends, fantasy football league. I'm trying to make a commitment to watching NFL every single week. So Nate, bringing you on to talk a little bit of NFL to get back in the huddle here. So I'm going to ask you some questions to get back into the NFL here, starting off with the Kansas City Chiefs, because I listened to your latest episode on Football 301. I noticed all three of you had the Chiefs ranked as the number 10 offense in the entire NFL. And so they were, last time I'm watching, number one during their season, number two, number three, best offense in the NFL. Typically every single season behind Patrick Mahomes and Andy Reid. What's gone behind that decline from, top one, top two, top three into number 10 on your rankings?
It's a weird thing when you have the same play caller and the same quarterback, like you start getting all these different iterations. Actually, the Patriots with, of course, Tom Brady and Bill Belichick are probably the best example of this. This is, it's pretty rare to get a dynasty and then we just get them back to back in the NFL somehow, some way. But with Mahomes in this offense, it's really just, all right, what are the surrounding pieces? And last year they faced a rut where they just had no explosive plays at all. They had nobody to take the top off the defense for a deep ball, but they also had nobody that could create with the ball in their hands. So it was death by 4 and 5 yard gains. And it was this weird, I mean, really, statistically, when I look at the NFL, I look at efficiency and I look at explosive plays. I think the best maybe comparison in basketball would be like 2 point, you know, at the rim percentage and then 3 point percentage. Like that's kind of like what you kind of look at for that. And the what the Chiefs have gone is like, we don't want to shoot outside 5 feet. We're not shooting any threes and we're just going to make everything at 5 feet. But that's really hard because then if you face a team, I don't know, like the Eagles that tackle really well, you could just get, you can't gain anything. It's 2 yard gain. Now it's 2nd and 8. And next play it's 3rd and 9. And oh, now we have a terrible left tackle because we had injuries at the offensive line. And we have nobody out there. So it's just kind of this trickle down effect of this tightness of this offense. Rashee Rice was hurt last year. He was a receiver for the Chiefs. He was really good the first month. I think he's going to be, he's on the, I wouldn't say cusp of stardom, but maybe that half step below that. I think he's a very good player. Once he got out, they had no ways to generate these explosive plays. So really it's more of a question.
Was he the guy supposed to replace Tyreek Hill?
Yeah, and he's a different style, but yes, in a way he is supposed to. In the weirdest way, he's almost a Travis Kelce slash Tyreek Hill replacement. I know Travis is still on the team, but he's my age. And that's my barometer now for old is he's I'm 36. A celebrity. Yeah. So it's like, are you my age? Old. And then we're good. We're good at that. I'm right at the cutoff there. So that's where he's really good horizontally and then taking the ball and getting vertically afterwards with the ball in his hands, as opposed to maybe Tyreek, who's good at that, but then down the field is where Tyreek really excels. So really where that number 10 ranking is like they get the benefit of the doubt that they're automatically going to be in that top 10 because they have Patrick Mahomes, because they have Andy Reid. It's more just they have questions. So it's funny that we all ranked them 10th because we all did it from the same line of thinking. It's like they deserve to be in here, but I don't know what it's going to look like this year because they just have questions. Having said all that, they drafted a left tackle named Josh Simmons in the first round. He dropped because of injury concerns. And then all of a sudden I thought he wasn't going to come back till the middle of this year. And he's already starting for them and playing. That's a total narrative changer because I think what a lot of us will think that, oh, you need explosive plays. You need the receivers for it. You have to block it up first to get there. So if he can play and just be average, it's better than what they had last year, which was outright terrible. So that's kind of a math changer a little bit for them. So they get the top 10 because of the quarterback, because they can be a very efficient. It's all about how explosive they can be, and that'll change their ranking based on how the season goes.
It's interesting, like with the Chiefs, because I always think of like Mahomes and Steph Curry kind of like, you know, NFL, you know, biggest stars, you know, most dynamic players, hardest to stop, right? And with the Warriors, they've had a little bit of a dip offensively where they're not, you know, best of the best, number one in offensive rating or number two in offensive rating every single year in the NBA. They're still great with Stephen Curry on the floor, but not quite. Other teams have caught up with the way NBA 3-point percentage, 3-point rate has caught up. The Warriors, it's like more normal, like what they do with their 3-pointers. It's not like it was when the dynasty was birthed. They've had personnel losses, like you're mentioning, the Chiefs did. Yep. They lose Clay Thompson. They lose, you know, Andre Iguodala, Sean Livingston's guys, these players that were part of the peak dynasty years. And now they're more, you know,
or draft good. Picks don't work out like Wiseman. Yes, like, exactly. You know, like, yep. Sorry to cut you off. But yeah, it's a great comparison.
There's busts, right? And so, like, part of it with the NBA is the league catching up. Is there an element of that with the Chiefs as well, with, you know, the evolution of the game and all, or is it more just strictly personnel with the Chiefs?
It's more personnel because what Andy Reid as a play designer is almost old school in a way. It's never been a very even though the numbers are good, it's not like a downfield attacking offense. It's very horizontal. It's you hear the term West Coast offense, and that's kind of been bastardized over the years. But he is a true blue West Coast offense guy, and that offense thrives on attacking horizontally, catching and running. And you need a pristine quarterback. Mahomes has just dropped this new element into that kind of attack. So it's not really that like defenses know what Andy Reid wants to do. It's like, can you stop it? Because he's such a good play designer. So it's not really they got caught up, to answer your question. It's more just that they need to reload their personnel a little bit. I'm more looking at Brett Veach, their GM, than anybody going like, all right, what do you got? Like, all right.
The Warriors you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah, like Juwan, even in free agency, they signed Juwan Taylor, who plays right tackle for them. and big money. It was a big deal when they signed him to, and it kind of surprised a lot of people, including me. I was like, you know, tackles are going to get paid. It's hard to find size and guys that can play offensive line free agency. But it was just, all right, what do they know? What do they know that I don't? Because I thought he was okay. And actually, I feel like I won the argument. Not that anyone was arguing with me that he actually is just okay and got overpaid. But just little things like that, they just never addressed these certain spots. And at first it was like, well, we got number 15. We got Mahomes. He'll clean it up for us. And now it's starting to catch up where it's like the offensive line. It's like, well, you still need these guys to block, or you still need another pass catcher to work out. So it's been a few Band-Aids last year, like DeAndre Hopkins and Juju Smith-Schuster at receiver. Like, oh, that's not really, you know, they missed on Sky Moore, who's a receiver from Western Michigan. He hasn't done anything in the league. So like these misses have led to Band-Aids, and now they're trying to fill the Band-Aids and just go, okay. So to answer your question, it's more personnel than anyone catching up to scheme or anything like that.
It's funny, like talking about the Chiefs last year, like, you know, out of the corner of my eye last year, I know they go 15-1 and they have a ton of close games. It's just crazy how a team that has this great record with Mahomes.
I wrote about it halfway through the season. I'm like, their baseline is way higher than people realize. It's more just, it's the ceilings that they can reach, you know, and and of course with the Chiefs, it's Mahomes and Taylor Swift, you know, when you see those games. But the defense and Steve Spagnuolo and Chris Jones have become just as big of a story as Mahomes, or just as important as Mahomes has been the last couple of years. So that's the thing too. It's like, well, the offense is dropping off. It's like, yeah, but the defense has risen. So it's kind of that it's like, as opposed to being number one offense and the 20th defense, now it's like the number nine offense and the number nine defense. You know, so it's more of a complete team now. So it's just, you know, it's a little narrative shift for people.
It's like inverse of the early years of the Patriots dynasty, where first it was elite defense and, you know, average offense, game managing to Tom Brady era. And then they become this elite all-time offense and their defense can't figure out how to get stops. It's the opposite of that. So now with Mahomes, you know, we'll see if, you know, Rashee Rice and all them get back to have a top five, top 10 offense. But it seems like you're saying they don't need to have that to be a great team. Now, moving on to the next topic, Baker Mayfield. He was ranked 50th on the NFL 100. Now, last time I watched Baker Mayfield, the dude sucked. Wasn't that good. you know, he got traded, I know, mid-season.
He was in Cleveland probably when you last watched him.
He was in Cleveland, yes. And I know he got traded to Carolina. He was never any good. Very average, below average, crap. How did he improve? What happened? Is this for real?
He's always okay. Yes and no. He's not to the top 10 rankings some people have him now or anything of that sort. He's more like a quality starter, you know, like just a fine starter.
Is 50th too high? 50th feels like outrageous to me.
That's really high, especially some of the quarterbacks he's above and all that. But I mean, if you look at his stats, and that's the thing, that's what's really hard with football too, is stats lie. But you also have to use stats to kind of like paint a picture. So it's like
41 touchdowns. Like, he has a lot of touchdowns.
You see that?
Big
top 10 quarterback, right? Yeah. 41 touchdowns. Right. Exactly. So it's that the Bucs are really fun. Like, they're going to be, I think, a top 10 offense this year. Why I want to talk about the whole offense is why I think Baker excelled last year. He's got a really good receiver room. Mike Evans, Chris Godwin. They just drafted another guy, Mecca Ibuka from Ohio State, that I really like. They also have talented running backs, Bucky Irving. Rashad White is actually a guy that's a nice little number two. But then they have a really, really, really good offensive line. And that's why Baker looked like Baker last year, is because Baker's worst tendencies are he feels a little bit of pressure. He goes into chaos mode. Like, all right, I'm bailing the pocket and let's street ball this a little bit.
That's the Baker I remember.
Yeah. And that's, he still has those tendencies. It's just that when in Cleveland, say, that was half the offense. You know what I mean? Like, there's more was on Baker. Now it's like Baker's got 15 different bailout options. And when he's doing that, it's like, you know, the first and second option were already really good. And then he bails out and it's like, oh, who am I going to scramble and throw to? Mike Evans? Okay, that's fun. You know, so it's the surrounding elements. And I think that's what's really hard. Quarterback discussions could, I mean, we could do 20 hours on it. But it's quarterbacks, it's hard. It's the most important position. But it's not the only position that matters. You know, like every position impacts the other position. If it's a big pie chart, the quarterback is maybe half of it, but the play caller, the offensive line, the skill guys are the other half of that. So Baker is at least his baseline as a top 18, top 20 quarterback, But when you get him a number top three surroundings, yeah, then he looks like how he looked last year. So he's not as bad as he was in Cleveland. He definitely is a little bit better, but he's not a top 50 player in the NFL to me. I think it's somewhere in between that. But yeah, it's the Bucs offense is very, very good.
It just seems crazy to me to have him 50th because I look again. I did not watch a Bucs game last year. 13 fumbles, led the NFL. 16 interceptions, led the NFL. He took 40 sacks with what you're saying was still a great offensive line.
Great offensive line.
Like, yes. On the surface, I'm seeing these basic numbers. I'm like, he's still a turnover machine. He's still taking a lot of sacks. Like, is it just because of, like, how much of the success of that offense is, like, yards after catch? Is it, like, the talent of these receivers versus him making, like, throws through tight windows and all that? Because I, on the surface, I just don't buy it. I don't buy it at all.
You're right. it's a lot of it's the receivers, too, because he had, God, I wish I knew this off the back of my hand because it's a good stat, but no one gained more first downs off receiver screens than Baker has in like the last decade. Like the receiver screens
were dink and dunk, a lot of short, yep, short
throw toes, screen. Yeah. And that's where the offensive line helps too, because those guys get out and block. And so if you have an athletic offensive line, they really open things up. That's also why Liam Cohn, the offense coordinator, who has done some really nice things for the Bucs last year. He's a Sean McVay guy. Now he's the head coach of the Jags. Why I'm kind of like, I'm optimistic, but I'm also going like, is he bringing the Bucs offensive line with him? Because that really, really, offensive line play is boring, but it matters so much. And honestly, it makes everybody's lives so much easier. I always say the offensive line is the floor lifter and then the skill guys are the ceiling lifter. So like that is when you're in that Bucs offense, it was like, oh, let's just run this basic play. Wow, it went for 6 yards. That was easy, right? Is because, yeah, you got an all-pro at center, an all-pro at left tackle. Like, that makes it a lot easier. So that's why I'm just kind of like, they get a lot of help, the quarterback and the play caller. So, like, yeah, those screens, like, he gained the most first downs, the highest success rate, the most EPA, which is expected points added. All those numbers were just off the charts with the Bucs last year. So it's like straight dropbacks, he was more like good. You know, as you know, stuff that he actually controlled, but not otherworldly, like 41 touchdowns and a top 50 ranking in the NFL 100.
I look forward to seeing where Jalen Hurts gets ranked this year, because I know he was 3 2 years ago, and I think he fell to 14 last year. Then the Eagles win the Super Bowl, and he'll probably be in the top 10, if not the top 5.
He'll be too high.
Yeah, too high. And you say too high, I mean, look, Jalen Hurts, he plays his role for the Eagles well, from what I can see. With him, did the Eagles win last year, like, because of him, despite him? Where are you at with Jalen Hurts and what it could mean for the Eagles this year?
Did the Warriors win back in the day because of Harrison Barnes? You know, that's kind of Jalen Hurts.
Which is crazy to say, because like you said, quarterback is the most important position, but it's not the only position, right?
The Eagles, and this is a credit to their GM, Howie Roseman, who gets a lot of praise from everybody. They've created one of the first quarterback and head coach independent teams that I've seen in the NFL, where they win games no matter what the head coach and the quarterback do. Because it was that defense was outstanding last year. I thought it would be good, but it was even better than I was expecting. And again, he probably has the top offensive line, at the very worst top three, but last year is probably the best. Has got an all pro receiver, an all pro running back, a Pro Bowl quality number two receiver, and a Pro Bowl quality tight end. That's a lot of help before I even get to the quarterback. So they have created this offense. And this is another thing too, when a quarterback is there for a while and has different offense coordinators, play caller matters a lot, and they're going to have a lot of input. But then once the quarterback's established, they have a lot of say on what gets called too. And no matter what they run, no matter who's calling plays, it's the Jalen Hurts offense. And that's a compliment and derogatory at the same time, because he's limited as a passer. He's really good at throwing certain routes, you know, go balls and corners, stuff to the outside. But if I were to ask him to do stuff that Lamar Jackson does as a thrower, or Josh Allen or Joe Burrow as a thrower, he's not even looking in the same direction as those guys are. So that's where I think people that analyze this stuff, me, some of your old coworkers at the Ringer, when we watch this, that's where it's hard with Jalen, is because he's good in his role. But I think a lot of guys could do what he does. So that's where, you know, your question kind of going like how much of an impact he is. I brought up that pie chart. He's more like a 25-30%, you know, for like the Eagles to me anyways. He's good at what he does, but they've streamlined everything. He doesn't have a handle on, you know, the quarterback stuff too, is that some guys in some offenses will dictate everything. Picture Tom Brady would be a great example, or Peyton Manning back in the day, Drew Brees back in the day, you know, point things out, getting everybody set. They don't do any of that for him. So that's kind of like where I'm like, I can only get so high with him, even if he's a Super Bowl MVP. Last year, he struggled for the second half of the year. It's just that everyone remembers the Super Bowl. And like there was time, I went on a Philadelphia show and they asked me if he should be benched and traded after the year. And then they ripped off three playoff wins and went to the and won the Super Bowl. So I was like, you know, now it's really easy to say because they again won the Super Bowl, but the journey there was not pretty. So it's kind of a hard discussion to say, yeah, quarterback matters a lot. But you know, it's just a different math and equation with the Eagles and the Hurts.
Totally. You know, it's interesting like what you're talking about with the way they've built their team out. It reminds me of what Rick Carlisle said on Caitlin Cooper's podcast. Carlisle, yes. Pacers head coach, he said a quote. He said, the NBA game has now become a play hard league. It's not just being top heavy with stars. Roster construction is changing. It's become more important to have more good players than be top heavy with two or three great players to get all the touches. Is there an element of that with the Eagles? And could that become a trend league wide in the NFL?
I was going to say, that is the trend. That is the NFL. The NFL is a matchup league and not just, oh, our best player, but more, all right, we have a B-plus receiver, but you have a C-minus corner. So we're just going to attack you all day with that. And we're going to pick at it. Playoff basketball is really translates well to week-to-week NFL play. As far as like, shoot, I just watched Mike Conley get picked on over and over and over, but that's the NFL. Like, but it's the good teams anyways. You have a right guard that can't pick up a blitz. All right. Well, we're going to keep blitzing them and we're going to keep running all these games and stunts at that right guard and we're going to get some sacks out of it. So that quote was amazing to me because that is what the NFL is. It's matchup league and it's the best coaches just go, okay, we're equal here. Oh, you suck at linebacker. And we got Jahmyr Gibbs at running back and we're going to run routes on him over and over and over. So that's, there was a lot to that. Like, and even pass catchers is kind of something I've been trying to grapple with. Do you need a true number one or do you need three guys that can all validly get open consistently, which is kind of like what Carlisle was talking about as well. So really to answer your question, yeah, it's not just the Eagles. It's just the entire NFL. And it's kind of always been like that. And I think the good coaches know that secret sauce as opposed to the other coaches maybe banging their head against the wall sometimes.
Kind of related to the conversation there, like with Carlisle and you know, NFL teams building out, exploiting matchups. Part of that is coaching too. Best game planners and all that. And that makes me think about the next team I want to talk about, the Lions, because last year they're one of the best, you know, stories in the entire league. They get this really nice team and then they, you know, fall short in the playoffs and then they lose both their coordinators. Ben Johnson, their offensive coordinator, left for the Bears. Aaron Glenn, their defensive coordinator, left for the Jets. This has only happened two other times in the last 15 years. The Eagles after 2022 lost both of their coordinators. The Bengals after 2013 lost both of theirs. To me, on the surface, this feels like reason for concern with the Lions for repeating what they did last year or building on what they did last year. Am I overly concerned just by looking at this on the surface, or am I in the right here?
No, you're in the right. I've been trying to grapple with this too. We just did our NFC North preview this week. And I actually was the only one that had under their win total right now is 10.5. And I picked under. I said that they could still make the playoffs, be a 9-8, 10-7 type team. But to me, it's that those coordinator drop offs, especially Ben Johnson, the offense coordinator going to the Bears. It's more about who they replaced him with. John Morton, who's been around. He's been a longtime assistant. He's coordinated one offense ever called plays, and it was terrible as the 2017 Jets. But it's not so much his fault as like a personnel kind of thing. Kind of just Ben Johnson, though, I hold in high esteem. And that's why I think no matter who came to replace him, there's going to be a drop off. This Lions team, though, is like they've done a really good job of just accumulating talent, which talent matters. Talent can overcome bad coaching to an extent. But I do think that, I'm not saying Morton's automatically going to be bad, but yada, yada, yada. Lions fans are really sensitive right now because they're finally like, we're winning and now you guys are criticizing us. I'm like, yeah, that's what happens. You're at the top
sounds
now.
Sounds like me with the Kings. They're having their light the beam season. I'm like, guys, this isn't enough. Like, you got to make some changes. This is going to fall short. And now I get Kings fans years later like, well, you know what? We still hate you, but you're right.
Expectations change. So that's why I'm looking at them. And they lost a couple offensive linemen. They have some, again, they've done a nice job of having a succession plan or somebody to step in, but you're going from a really quality center. I say really quality, great English there, Nate. High quality center in Frank Ragnow. He's gone. And they replaced him with a guy that's been a long time kind of spot starter backup type, Graham Glasgow. But it's like one of these things where, say, a Lions fan going like, well, he started a bunch of games. I'm like, yeah, but he's okay. You're going from great to okay. And that's a drop-off. Even if he's fine, he's just fine. And then now you're starting
doesn't
a rookie.
Doesn't that matter more for a quarterback like Jared Goff? He's not this elite of the elite. He's more so game manager category, right?
You get it. Because that's the thing. That's where quarterbacks can overcome these things. The great ones. The top six guys, whatever, five guys. The guys like Goff in the Goff tier, the Baker tier. Geno Smith,
like how is he start? Like these crap quarterbacks from 5 years ago are solid now. It just blows my mind.
Wait until we talk about
Jared
Sam Darnold.
Oh my God, what the hell? What is going on?
That must be such a mind screen for you.
Does not make any sense. Right?
Jacoby Brissett starting for the Patriots are like, wait a second.
Crazy. Oh my God. Why is he back?
Yeah. You're like, did he never leave?
Oh
no, but that it matters, like the succession plan for these guys. And when you don't have a dude at quarterback, that's why I have questions. Even though they have such good, so many high quality players and such talented players at receiver and running back and all this stuff, I think I underrated maybe their defense a little bit on our top 10 defenses show. But still, it's one of these things. You're still replacing a coordinator. You still have some question marks that I have to see. But the defense, I am more optimistic about maybe than I was even a couple weeks ago as I kind of marinated on it. But the offense, it's like they were so good. So good, top of the class. It's just even if there was a natural regression that all these teams face, like, but now you're losing your kind of one of the secret sauce aspects, the Ben Johnson offense coordinator. So that's where I had him at eighth as the offense, but it's just one of these things where it's not number one supernova offense. That's a drop off. That's a big drop off. So I'm a little more, I would say pessimistic, but I do think there's going to be some regression from the team, even if I do think they'll still be good this year.
We'll be right back. Super Bowl, they lose, they go to the conference championship the year after that, and they've had 2 9-8 seasons since then. What's one thing they're missing?
One, an entire defense. if it's just okay. One.
Good to know. So it's not the offense starters, at all.
10 starters on defense. That's basically it. It really is. We did our AFC North preview this week, and I predicted them to go 9-8 again because I was just kind of going through it and doing the math on it. I'm like, I think their offense is going to be a top offense. I really do. And I think they've insulated themselves well. I think they're going to add layers, yada, yada, yada. But then when we got to the win total part, when we're picking over under wins, I'm like, but why do we feel like the defense will improve? Last year, the offense was great. And this defense was about what it's going to be this year. And they went 9-8. Like, where's the improvement coming from? So I think they're still going to be stuck in this tier. Next year might be a different story. Some of the young guys grow. Maybe the defense coordinator, Al Golden, does a nice job. But I'm predicting another 8-9, 9-8 season for them. They're really reminding me a lot of the 2010s Saints. Amazing offense. Drew Brees is amazing. Defense stinks. And they go 7-9 every year. You know, that's what they kind of did year in, year out. Or the Ots Colts are a version of this, where Peyton Manning's just, they're scoring 500 points a year. But depending on how good their defenses was how their season went, up or down. Bob Sanders was great. They would go to the Super Bowl. If they have nothing, they have the 30th defense, and they lose after the first round. Like, so that's kind of where I think this Bengals tier is. They're a fun team, but that defense still needs another at least one more year, I think.
If this were NBA media, we'd be saying, should Joe Burrow demand a trade?
See, that's easy. That's the easiest lever to pull. Like, the NFL trades are so hard too, because the contracts are so funny, so much funny money, that it's like you can kind of create a trade with anybody if you kind of, if you really stick with it. I don't have a trade machine. I could just stick these guys in and go, okay, does that work?
I know it's a lot more complicated with trades. NBA trades have become more complex, but
yeah,
there's aprons, always a way. Oh, the second apron, the first apron,
oh my God,
and all these little rules I try and to qualifiers.
Cross pollinate and learn like other caps and baseball and basketball. Well, baseball doesn't have a cap, but there's stuff too, luxury tax and basketball stuff like Larry Coon's Q&A, CBA Q&A. That I don't even know he still has it, but I used to study it. but like, I remember going through it all and I'm like, birds rights, early bird rights. Oh my God. Like, what are we doing here? Like, what MLE? Okay. I have to go through each one.
It's crazy. Like, all these different rules. And, you know, with the Warriors right now with Jonathan Kuminga, as I talked about with Grant Lifman earlier on the podcast, like, there's just a lot going on still in the NBA because of the new CBA and the new rules that have made it more complicated for restricted free agents. So we'll see what happens with that. But so Bengals.
And as soon as you figure out, they'll change it.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It's like, I got it. Oh, then they revise it. So Bengals, no defense. That's the one thing they need is an entire defense.
A lot of it.
Which coach is entering the season on the hottest seat right now?
Oh, man. Mike McDaniel with the Dolphins. Oh, yeah. It's weird vibes there.
Jeez, he is like got off his rocker.
He's.
I would not want that guy as my head coach. He just feels so.
Yeah, like I want him on my staff. To me. Not as the head coach. Yeah, it's one of those where everything's great when you're scoring points and winning games in the NFL or any sport, really. What happens when you go on that first losing streak? All right, what happens if you go 2 years in a row and you miss the playoffs? Well, they didn't miss the playoffs last time, but you lose your season because you go on that losing streak. And on top of it, okay, our entire offense, our entire philosophy is we're going to outrun and outspeed everybody. And now we have to turn the dial and now we're going to try and be tough. You just don't do that overnight. That's a day one philosophy thing. You know, you'd have to bring in a whole new group of personnel. So it's just one of these where it's, I feel like just his time is done there, or like his messaging has, unless they just overhaul the whole thing. So yeah, Mike McDaniel to me is the one on the hot seat. I'm trying to think of another one, but that was the first one that comes to mind, the easiest one to argue for. So kind of rolling with that one too.
I mean, I see his pressers. He's a strange guy, which, you know, all the, like, no disrespect, like people be true to yourself, but like as a head coach to be the leader of men, that's where I'm like, I just don't see how that's going to resonate or stick, how that's going to last. Eventually, I think that's going to wear thin on players in a locker room, guys who also have a voice where it's like, this guy is our head coach? I don't know. I just, it's just strange to me. The sunglasses, it's just become a kind of a Miami guy. He's just changed. He's gone from the geek to the jock in some ways. It's strange.
He's a really smart. I worked with him in Atlanta. He's a really smart guy. He is quirky. And some of that is to disarm you, to like, you know, play possum a little bit, like kind of go like that. But the thing is, like you just said, but not as a head coach.
Yeah.
Like it's like as the coordinator, as the quarterback coach, or their like run game.
The smart aleck types, you know, that type
of
thing.
Yeah, the lieutenant. Yeah, exactly. I don't like it either. Yeah. You can have that as your number two, but not as the number one. I'm in agreement with you. And then once you meet Kyle Shanahan, because him and Kyle Shanahan are very good friends, and you understand, because Kyle's different. Kyle's more like never smiles, kind of like more even keeled. So it's kind of like, oh, okay, I can see why you guys ended up becoming friends. It's a lot. They have a fun relationship too, actually, just diving into that. Like I think he was the video guy's son in Denver when Kyle's dad was the head coach with the Broncos, Mike Shanahan. And that's how they became friends. And I actually understand that, because when my dad was a coach, I was ball boy and I was friends with like the video guy's kid and all that stuff. But he didn't end up becoming a head coach or anything. So sadly,
I don't know anything that changed this offseason. What's the most impactful offseason move? Number one.
Ben Johnson going to the Bears.
Really? I mean, I wanted the Patriots to get him. I'm happy with Vrabel, but you know, Ben Johnson was the guy that I was all excited about.
That was interesting to me, that whole timeline, because it was Vrabel's job. Like, you know, it was like, hey, we're going to interview other people. But then Ben Johnson came, they gave Ben Johnson an interview, an in-person one, I believe, as opposed to the Zoom ones he was doing. And then they went, well, we want a second interview with him. And that was interesting to me, because it meant, oh, he knocked our socks off. oh, shoot, we got to change this. Like, okay, are we sure? All right. And they double checked and they went with Vrabel anyways. But also, that should be a really good sign about your quarterback, who I'm really high on, Drake May, that because Ben Johnson was only going to a team with a dude at quarterback. And so really the only three teams that he ended up being a finalist with were New England, Chicago with Caleb Williams, and Jacksonville with Trevor Lawrence. All guys that some people maybe are like, oh, really? But it's like he sees the talent and goes, no, I can work with that. So I thought that was interesting too. Like, what did he think of the teams? If I can get $15 million and sign with anybody, and he's supposed to be a really well-read, researched guy, like, okay, what did he think were the teams to go to? And so he went New England, Jacksonville, and Chicago. And I thought that kind of piqued my interest a little bit. But
interesting. Did he make a good choice with Caleb Williams? He did not have the best rookie season.
And not only just with Caleb, but the rest of the personnel there. They got some receivers. They got some young talent there. The defense is going to be good. Like he also hired a really good defense coordinator, Dennis Allen, who was the head coach with the Saints recently. I love that move because he's going to be an offensive play caller as a head coach. That's a little scary always to me. Okay, new play caller, my first time being a head coach. Or I'm sorry, new first time being a head coach, and I'm still going to call plays. That's just a lot on a guy. And while I think he can handle it, he seems like a sharp guy. I love that he went, I'm going to hire a veteran defense coordinator. You got it. And now I don't have to worry about it. And you're a former head coach. So those little things, I, again, this is kind of narrative scouting with this. I like those signs, though. He hired a veteran offensive line coach. I like that they made a bunch of moves acquire offensive linemen. And not just offensive linemen in theory or like, just because it's different doesn't mean it's better. Charles McDonald, my co-host, used that line. And I always like that. Like, just because it's different doesn't mean it's good. But they actually acquired guys that had talent and actually are going to be upgrades. You know, so there's all these little things that I'm like, okay, I think you get it. Like, and again, I might be putting the cart before the horse. He hasn't coached one single game. But these are the signs I want to see. Like, it's just these little things. I'm like, okay, it's not Nathaniel Hackett with the Broncos. You know, that's where I'm like, oh, this is the opposite of what I want to see. So Ben Johnson to the Bears is very significant to me. But, you know, there's other players, like minor players going to the teams too. But that's more like my quirky fun. It's not the most impactful thing. It's more like, oh, that's fun. Like Mykel Williams going to the 49ers draft pick, yada, yada, yada.
Now, the Patriots, I mentioned earlier, I was very fortunate. I'm born in 1990. I was born at the perfect time to become a sports fan.
A
Boston sports fan. I mean, like I've experienced more winning than many will ever have in multiple lifetimes. Very spoiled growing up. I've felt the highs and lows of the Patriots dynasty all through the years. And Tom Brady last year gets his jersey retired. This year, today, tomorrow, Friday, he's having a statue revealed outside of Gillette Stadium. And I hope to God it looks 10 times better, nowhere as bad as Dwayne Wade's statue in Miami, which is the worst statue ever in history. So I hope they perfectly, you know, replicate Tom Brady and his beauty as a quarterback and as a winner and as the GOAT and as a human. I'm not sure if you're a Patriots fan or not. I'm a Tom Brady fan and a Patriots fan. So, I mean, Tom Brady, you know, I'm very happy. I look forward to seeing how that happens. But I love that dude. He's part of what made me such a big sports fan over the years, watching him win, watching him lead. I remember his famous quote where he quoted his old, I think, equipment manager at Michigan, where he said, "What's your favorite ring? The next one." And I think he always embodied that with his work ethic. So I think it's awesome that Tom Brady's going to get this honor. What's your favorite Tom Brady moment from his career, Nate?
Oh, my God. One of the highlights that always sticks out to me, well, the whole 2007 season, when they acquired, because I grew up with Randy Moss with the Vikings. And so when he goes to Oakland, he gets traded there, kind of goes to the nether realm that is the Oakland Raiders. Now they're Vegas, but goes to the Patriots and they played the Dolphins in that first month, I want to say, first month or 5-6 weeks of the season. And Tom Brady Tom Brady up until that point was whether it was fair or not, we've learned that it wasn't, was known as a game manager. Oh, he's really good. Just their defense first. They run the ball, yada, yada, yada.
I used to argue with people on a forum years ago. I'm like 12, 13, 14 years old, arguing about Tom Brady versus Trent Green.
Oh,
that was the discussion on forums back then.
Because Trent Green was a game manager and on some loaded Chiefs offenses too. That's fun. See,
and then 07 comes and he shows who he is. The GOAT
actually is. Yeah. Well, I mean, shoot, I grew up around Dante Culpepper in 02, 03, 04, 05. Single person would have gone, oh, Dante Culpepper over Tom Brady. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And then now if you said that, everyone would be like, what? Who's Dante Culpepper? Like,
I used to play as the Vikings in Madden. Culpepper and Moss. Just
the greatest Madden team ever. Everybody's fast. It was like by design. That's how my dad built those teams. Everybody's 99 speed. Let's go. Great Madden teams. That first month they played the Dolphins and Tom just let it rip. He threw one to Randy Moss in like triple coverage. And it was like this deep post over route. He should not have thrown it. And you can tell Tom Brady's like, this is fun. I can just unpin grenades and launch it. And I remember I was a freshman in college at UCF. I transferred to Wisconsin after that year. But in my freshman year, when I'm sitting in my dorm, I think we had a game. Oh, no, that was a Sunday, obviously, but so we didn't. Must have had a workout. I come back. And I remember just watching that throw. And I'm like, Tom Brady's just launching stuff down the field. I was like, oh, it's Randy. Duh. But that play, and it's just a random play, but that one's the one that always sticks out to me. A funny one is when he tells Gronk to stand up. Do you remember that little clip? He goes, Gronk's in a 3-point stance, and he goes, Gronk, stand up. And Gronk just stands up right away. And that those little things, like there's a little more minor plays that stand out to me, but like that Dolphins game is just like a vivid memory of like Tom Brady, like the new Tom Brady that we all know now. But that in 2007, that was a big change, big mind shift for everybody to go like, oh, my God, this is what you can do. we didn't know this. So, yeah, I would say that maybe I don't know if it's a moment, but the 2007 season. And he almost hit that Hail Mary against the Giants. And he threw that ball like 80 yards to Randy.
Oh, my God, dude.
And that throw also is always burning in my brain because, again, I didn't know Tom Brady could throw the ball 75 yards.
It's burned into mine, too, Nate. It is burned into mine, too. You know how many times I've watched the highlights? I've watched the entire fourth quarter because I like to hurt myself, apparently. Just so many moments. The fourth and one, Brandon Jacobs, Asante Samuel on the sideline. Idiot.
Everything.
Dropping the interception. Just, so many moments in that game. I still can't believe
you remember all the losses.
Lost to Eli twice. You kidding me?
and they'll never let you forget. At least it's New York fans, and they don't like to talk crap at all. So it's like, you know,
it's crazy. But you know, I think part of it though is like I think as a sports fan, sometimes experiencing the losing is what leads to greater satisfaction with the winning. Like it was different winning the first Super Bowl because like, I'm just a kid, but also, you know, it was like a new quarterback, new team. Like it was like a magical story, the dynasty winning 3 and 4 years and all that. It was beautiful, right? But then losing for a long time until winning the next three. And then the fashion in which they did, Malcolm Butler against Seattle, of course, 28-3 against Atlanta, just like in historic, like memorable fashion, just amazing games, like some of the greatest games in sports history. Like to me, like I think the moment I will always remember most is down 28-3 in the third quarter. I'm watching the game to my dad, and I turn to him. I'm like, you know, we got Tom Brady. Like, we still have a chance. And my dad's like, I don't know. Like, it's very unlikely, but we got Tom Brady. And that was the belief Tom Brady instilled in you as a fan and with his teammates, where it's like, you got this guy. You feel like you get a chance. You just feel like you have a chance. Mahomes does that now with the Chiefs. When you have Stephen Curry in the NBA, you feel like you have that. There's just these rare talents where it's like you always feel like you still can win the game no matter what the score is. And I think it was that moment where it was like just crystallized everything and like who he is as a player. And like it's just that moment being down 28-3 that I always remember turning to my dad saying, like, we still got a chance because we got Tom Brady. Saw it so many times.
So true. That's what I try to explain with the difference between the guys, the quarterbacks that are good and what I always say, the dudes, like the guys that are actually in that upper echelon, which to me is only three. And then, you know, Burrow is just on the cusp of it to me. But I think it's Mahomes, Allen, and Lamar Jackson, Josh Allen, Lamar Jackson. And just because of what you said there, down, or it's a 2-minute drill. They have no timeouts, 1:10 left, and they need a field goal. Who's quarterback? Josh Allen, Mahomes, Lamar. Oh, okay, they're going to get it. Like, I'm more surprised that they don't get the field goal than if they do, which most quarterbacks say, like we brought up, Jared Goff or, you know, even a guy, Jalen Hurts. Some of the other guys that I consider more the middle tier, I'd be like, you know, this, we'll see. You know, hopefully a guy breaks a tackle here. But that's what guys like Tom Brady and those guys, that's what they do. It's not automatic, but they make it feel automatic. It's the Steph Curry discussion as well. He's launching, pulling up a 30-footer with, you know, as the shot clock's running out or the quarter's running out. It's like, yeah, that's going in. Like the fact that they can warp your brain to go like, going from to like, no, that's going in. Like that's what the dudes do. Like, and that's, yeah, Brady is one of the dudes, all time dudes, obviously.
And with Lamar, we'll see if he can do it in the playoffs as well.
Playoffs, that'll, yes. That's the big
question this year with the Ravens. Speaking about the playoffs, you're a fan of the team that has lost two Western Conference finals in a row, yes, in the Minnesota Timberwolves, but they're, you know, yeah, Anthony Edwards still in his young 20s, still on the up and up. What's on your mind with Minnesota entering the season, Nate?
Well, they lost NAW, Alexander Walker. And so really it's more like watching these playoff losses, like watching the talk about also the journey. I've experienced a lot of losing with my teams. I'm a Timberwolves and Seattle Mariners fan. So it's pretty fun right now to actually be able to like talk and be like, oh, who are they drafting next year? Hopefully we get a lottery pick. You know, actually like focusing on this, but like how they replace NAW as a 3-and-D guy is something kind of grasps me. And what's kind of cool is I think they have guys on the roster that are going to step up. I think I messaged you this as well, but the that's kind of what I'm focusing on, because when I watched those playoffs last year, they need someone else that can, they need to let Anthony play off ball in the playoff time, and especially what the Thunder did to them. And the year before that against Dallas, Anthony got worn out as the series went along. I mean, Kyrie was taking him to the cleaners for a little bit there because he was trying to do so much on offense. And he was like, yeah, I'm picking up Kyrie too. And it's like, well, it's playoffs. You got to focus on one and then maybe you can step up with the other. So when I'm watching this team, it's like, what are these auxiliary creators? You know, I think maybe it is what I'm focusing on. Who is the backup guard? Point guard, I should say, behind Mike Conley. Like that's a big discussion too, and also part of this as well. So I'm focused on these young guys, TJ Shannon, Rob Dillingham, and it's like those guys becoming contributors this year is kind of makes or break the season, because they need those auxiliary creators, auxiliary scorers, guys that can do stuff with the ball in their hands a little bit. So that's really, I watched every summer league game like it was all 22 film for football. I have every Timberwolves game recorded on YouTube TV, and I'm pouring through that stuff and going like, okay, all right. Oh, I didn't really like that, Rob. Okay, that was good there. And so that's what I'm watching, is what these young auxiliary creators can kind of do this year, because if they step up, then I'm very excited.
It's not a perfect comparison, but like you guys signed Bones Highland to a two-way contract, and he's interesting because when Denver won the finals the first year, their GM at the time traded Bones Highland midseason because Michael Malone, the head coach of the Nuggets at the time, loved Bones Highland, but he was blocking Christian Brown from playing minutes. Christian Brown ended up playing a pivotal role for the Nuggets as a rotation guy, as a rookie in their run to the NBA Finals, and they win it. With Minnesota last year, I felt like a lot of the time Finch was just like leaning on the older guys. Like you didn't see a lot of Terrence Shannon. You didn't see a lot of Rob Dillingham. And I feel like they lose Nickeil Alexander-Walker, which is a loss. But the fact they didn't sign like this clear-cut vet, like here's our backup point guard, here's our new wing. It says to me that Tim Conley, the Wolves GM, is like, okay, Finch, you have no choice. You're going to play the youth. You're going to play the young guys, whether you like it or not, because these are the best options for you coming off the bench behind our starters. And I think that's the right approach, because with Dillingham, with Terrence Shannon, like even to an extent, Jalen Clark, who I do like these guys are like, we saw Terrence Shannon have some good minutes for Minnesota in the playoffs. After not playing really at all during the regular season.
Against the Thunder. It wasn't even the first round.
No kidding. Exactly. And he had some good moments. And then with Dillingham, like he's a small guard. He's like 6'1", 6'2", without shoes. They traded, you know, up in the first round to number 8 to get him. So clearly Tim Conley, who is a great talent evaluator, identified Dillingham as a guy who can someday be the replacement for Mike Conley, and in the meantime, being a guy who can be a spark off the bench and maybe a guy that can play heavy minutes for you despite his lack of size. And I think that's what's interesting with the way the Minnesota's building this kind of whole thing out, because all summer, they're trying to get Kevin Durant. They're putting Rudy Gobert on the table, and then they draft two bigs. They had Berenger in the first round and Zakarinski in the second round. So they draft two seven-footers. Berenger, who looked really good defensively in summer league. I'm sure you're
oh, I'm fired up, man. Yeah, I'm so fired up. He moves like a star. Like, I can't get – like I say, I cross-pollinate and try and study other things. Like, he moves like a star. So I'm like, okay, I know he's 18. He'll probably barely – you know, he's the fourth big this year, whatever. But it's like, no, that I'm good with this. Like, this guy does not move like a 18-year-old and growing into his body and figuring out his limbs. It's like, this guy moves like how the really good players move. I know there's a long way to go, but I'm like, yeah, that was fun. That was a fun summer league for an 18-year-old that I watched five minutes of before the draft.
He's really, really raw. I mean, like he looked like a guy that you can feel good about in the future. Like with Gobert, he becomes not tradable yet because you still need Rudy Gobert with his defense to be, you know, anything relevant on the defensive end of the floor. But if Berenger and these guys eventually become quality NBA players, it gives them more flexibility as they build around Dillingham, Edwards, and Shannon, these guys you'd hope in the years to come. So, I mean, I'm cautiously optimistic about Minnesota despite losing Alexander Walker because of my belief in Dillingham and Shannon as players. It's just a matter of, is Finch going to invest in those guys, even if it means short-term pain for long-term gain? I think that's what Minnesota is going to have to deal with, where maybe you don't have as high of a seed, but that's what's tough in the West, man. Like, the West is so loaded. You do need to focus on winning during the regular season, or else you're the seventh seed or the eighth seed, and then you're fighting to get in the playoffs. It's just, it's so hard, man. But ultimately, I'm optimistic. I'm optimistic about Minnesota, Nate.
Last year, after a bunch of guys got hurt, Julius Randle and others got hurt, the changes they made after that, it was like, oh, Finch is good. Like, you know, it was just like they kind of remolded the guys' roles and kind of just shifted a few things around. So that was about February-ish. And I would say that was when I was like, because I was – the first month or so of the season, I was like, we're going to miss the playoffs. Like, oh my God. Like, I was expecting another run here, at least a playoff series win. And then, the end of the season, they were one of the hottest teams and they're doing so well on both sides of the floor. But your whole point about the GM forcing the coach to play players, that is a cross sport, cross league thing that happens so much. It happens in football all the time because coaches are so scared of losing their jobs. They're like, I don't want to start this third round rookie. And then it's like, well, you have to. Sorry. Figure it out.
No choice. Make it happen.
Figure it out.
You know what? Sometimes it ends up for the best because, you know, you see OKC win the title with a bunch of young guys that they invested in. Denver, the year they won it, Christian Brown as a rookie as part of the rotation, had some good moments. Yeah. Sometimes it's worth the investments to do that. But, Nate, thanks for joining me today, man. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a blast. I'm glad. Got a little cross sports in there, so that felt good.
Hell yeah, man. We'll do this again during the season. Where can we find your stuff, Nate?
Oh, of course, on Yahoo. Yes, I just wrote about what to look for in the preseason on each game. Really just an excuse to talk about Shedeur for a minute. Shedeur Sanders. But no, you can find it on Yahoo. You can find me on social media at Nate_Tice on X, and also Nate Tice on Blue Sky. So all that good stuff right there. The clips are coming. We got some preseason games coming, so you'll start seeing a lot of football all 22 clips coming out.
Beautiful, Nate. Thank you so much for joining me today. Have a good day.
Thanks for having me.
Big thank you to Nate Tice and Grant Liffen for joining me. Thanks to Emmy for producing today's episode. We'll be back again next week with more NBA talk, maybe a little bit of NFL too. Maybe we'll go back in the huddle again. Have a great day, everybody. Enjoy your weekend.